My guest today on In the Arena is Joe Barr, the recently retired or retiring CEO of John Holland, an organisation, for those who are familiar, who take on some of the biggest infrastructure projects in many ways that you could actually imagine. And Joe's the person who ultimately has to wake up to the consequences of all the things that could and might and probably will go wrong when you're managing projects of such complexity and obviously complicatedness. And we do spend a little bit of time trying to differentiate between the two. He's also a person who I think exemplifies many of the things that we seek to coach in the leaders that I work with. And a lot of the work comes down to this question of what does the role expect of me? And the answer is always to create the conditions which enable a group or organisation to be its best, to reach its full potential. And then really the question itself, what does it expect of me, really is, comes down to moments. What does this moment expect of me? And I always speak of four words when it comes to those moments. And the first one is, what would a calm leader do? And often it's in the face of, you know, really challenging moments, which can actually bring out the worst in our emotions. The second question is, what would a brave leader do? You know, we often talk about authenticity and its importance to leadership. But in my experience, authenticity is how we experience a person. It's more an outcome. And there's no authenticity without vulnerability, and there's no vulnerability without bravery. And the next one is, and the third one is, what would a humble leader do? And in those moments of challenge, often it feels as a leader that it's actually about you, but it's never about you. It's all on you, but never actually about you. And the fourth one is compassion, or what would a compassionate leader do, or a kind leader do? Knowing that there are so many people who have aligned their careers, particularly in an organisation the size of John Holland, with how you show up as a leader. And as I've experienced with Joe over a number of years, but certainly in this interview itself, is he exemplifies all four of those things. I think you'll enjoy this conversation, particularly those who are in those CEO roles. It's very much a CEO to CEO conversation, but it certainly brings, you know, a great sense of Joe's, the work that he's done on himself, you know, that it's this idea, if it's not happening in you, it won't happen through you. And he's a guy who's done the work. You'll love this conversation. It was one that I was very pleased to have. So welcome, Joe Barr, into the arena. I'm here with Joe Barr, who I've got to know in recent times. And today's a little bit of a different conversation. There's a sporting context because I never fall far from that domain. And there is a little bit of sport that I will touch on through family later in the conversation. But Joe's the CEO, still the CEO of the John Holland Group, and who I've got to know in recent times, and found myself connecting at a deep level with the CEO to CEO conversation. And my sense today is it's going to very much fall into that domain. So this is going to be a conversation, I think, for people who are in CEO roles or certainly aspiring to those CEOs. So welcome to In the Arena, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and when I talk to In the Arena, what sort of comes up for you is, it's not clearly the sporting arena as we've as many of the people I've spoken to, but what comes up for you when I speak of In the Arena?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things that come to mind. When you and I first met, I'd been asked to come along to a CEO mentoring session with the ex-CEO of ANZ Bank, Mike Spett. Yeah. And in that forum, it was a great opportunity to be with other CEOs, all from different sectors. And during that number of sessions that we had, we were able to put things on the table that were in a private arena, if you like, about what were we challenged with and how could others that have an understanding about what the CEO role is and how we can share concerns and frustrations and challenges in a pretty safe space. So that sort of conjures up that sort of, that's the arena, that meeting that we're in, or series of discussions that we had. So that's one, I guess. And then for me, the John Holland journey has been wonderful. And a very special part of that, connected to sport, is the building of Allianz Stadium and building capacity within the company to be able to bid on the job, win the job, and then deliver it. So I wasn't quite in the arena, but I was putting it together.
Yeah, you're building arenas for for that to happen. So a couple of thoughts come to mind that even the forum that where we met was the idea of there's almost an unexpected loneliness when it comes to taking on the role as CEO. But there's also I think, and it takes a little bit of time, certainly did for me, is a recognition that the loneliness of the role doesn't mean you need to be alone. And, you know, so to actually find someone who would, whilst their experiences of that might be a little bit different, there's certainly a deeper connection which can only come from the understanding and insights that the role gave. How did you find when you became the CEO that aspect of the loneliness of the role? What comes up for you there?
Well, I guess to me, I have been in the property development construction industry for a long time and traveled, been lucky enough to sort of have lots of different experiences within different countries and so on. And one of the things I very purposely did when I joined John Holland, I had learned a lot through previous roles when I was beginning, and certainly leadership roles. And one of the things I really wanted to do was just be my genuine self. Just approach the role with a degree that was just me. And therefore, what I found in doing that, by that I mean I'd been in building and property prior to John Holland, but I hadn't known a lot about rail and infrastructure. And it's quite different how that aspect of the construction industry is delivered. And what I decided to do was just be very genuine about what I knew and what I didn't know. And therefore, answering that question about being lonely, I found myself giving myself the license to ask lots of questions. They have to be informed questions, obviously, but to people who knew a lot more about me. And that opened up a whole world of people sharing with me, wanting the company to be successful, wanting them to be successful, wanting me to be successful. And therefore, it never felt that lonely because I always had a camaraderie with the staff in the company, with consultants outside, et cetera, and others who I met along the journey. And I think that concept of just being yourself, being curious, asking lots of questions sort of made it it didn't make it a very lonely place at all.
It's a wonderful insight. There's almost your lack of understanding by going into domains of which you didn't have expertise almost worked in your favour in that time because it sort of gave you probably one or two choices. You could either pretend, and I don't think that's your natural state, or you could be the person who embraces being the learner rather than the knower in that environment. And in doing so, you built connection probably for both them and you in that time.
And at all levels too, Cam. A quick story about my first few weeks in John Holland. I had the luxury of being able to travel around the company, and we do lots of work all around the country, right? And in Singapore and Malaysia. And one of the first jobs I visited was a rail maintenance job in Western Australia. You're about an hour out of Perth, and we're on the side of this railway line. And the team there were repairing, maintaining the railway line. And I didn't know anything about that. And I was standing beside this railway siding, and the team for the day was just having this toolbox talk, talking about the task ahead and how they do it safely, et cetera, et cetera. And because I just started, people didn't know me and they didn't know who I was. And a lot of these people, particularly people, wouldn't even know my name. So the supervisor says to me, Joe, we're doing a toolbox. Do you want to join us on the toolbox? And I said, sure. So I was in my jeans and high this shirt and helmet, et cetera. And the team was talking about the task for the day and their safety. And about a quarter of the way through that, I said to them, hey, guys, those two big machines on the track, how do you stop one from banging into another one when they're working? And the guy beside me sort of looked at me and gave me a bit of a, you know, curious glance. And then they went off talking about something else. And a couple of minutes later, I asked the same question. And they sort of didn't ignore me, but sort of gave me a bit of an answer. And then I asked again. I wasn't sure how that machine would stop going into the other one. And then one guy turned around to me and said, "Who the hell are you?" So then I introduced myself as, "Hi, I'm Joe. I'm the new CEO." But I guess that was illustrative of what ensued after that was this lovely ability for them to explain what they were doing to someone who I felt I was genuinely interested in the safety of these, and I knew enough to know that was a dangerous circumstance and you needed to learn from all that. From then I just asking lots of questions, being curious, enable me to engage with all levels, whether it be the labourer on a building site or the Premier of Victoria or New South Wales. Just asking lots of questions is a licence I gave myself.
Yeah, there's a very underestimated courage in all of that, and you might necessarily think like that. There's a line which I found myself quoting more than I ever thought I would, given the work that I do, it's from Bono in his book Surrender, when he talks about, as in U2's Bono, he says, "The hardest thing to be on stage is yourself." He says, "The hardest thing to be on stage is yourself." And so you found yourself in those, and often I found myself in those unfamiliar, scenarios where, you just think, how did I end up here? And at both levels, yeah. Like, the meeting with the Premier or, at a very base level, country football club or, whatever it might be. And you just wonder about your capacity to connect it at either level. But somehow we tend to overestimate the circumstance we find ourselves in, but we also underestimate our capacity to deal with, whatever that thing's throwing at us at that stage. And so your courage to be just the learner, not the knower in that moment, almost gives you permission to be you, just to be you.
Yeah. And I actually think that if I reflect on it, in my earlier phases of my career, I didn't do that, because starting off in any industry, but certainly starting off in construction, it's a tough industry. It's long hours. And I remember distinctly when I began in my career, the company who I started with, Lendlease, said to us, "Look, there's 40 of you graduates in this intake. By the end of this first year, there will only be 15.
Right.
And some of you won't like it. You won't like the hours. Some of you won't like the people. Some of you won't like the stress, et cetera, et cetera." And they really ratcheted up the pressure that I felt about having to succeed and not be one of those 25 people that dropped out in that first year. And if I reflect on that, it was probably, for me, a good experience, but it was a lot of pressure. And then trying to be someone else, sort of purporting to know more than you did, a feeling as though you needed to know more than you did, was quite an early stress in my early career that in my later part of my career, certainly the John Holland career, as I say, I gave myself license to say, "Tell me more about this. Can you explain this? How does this work?" And those open questions are just gold, because people open up and you create a conversation between two human beings rather than two, a report and their boss type of thing. It's quite a very simple philosophy, but I think if I go back in my career, I learned how to do that a lot better as I progressed through my career.
Was there any tipping point on that? Was where your previous way wasn't serving you well? Was there any lesson learned, or was it over just a period of just growing and learning and finding out more about yourself?
Yeah, there was a pretty early tipping point when I joined Lendlease, and I was an engineer on a shopping centre, not shopping centre in Melbourne, was getting a big expansion. And I come from university, and the people I was working with, my boss at that stage was a site supervisor. And that site supervisor was quite a hard-nosed individual, a driver of people, and in a very, very male-dominated industry. We still are. Hopefully, you know, we have improved, but back then it was very male-dominated. And it was all about long hours and quite a difficult environment. And I remember my job at that stage was to help my foreman by ordering reinforcing for the concrete pours, by ordering concrete, by measuring the formwork, et cetera, and getting everything organized. And about 6 months into that experience, we had a concrete pour one afternoon that we were one morning that we were going to do, and we're all set up for the pour. And the architect had changed the dimensions of the tiles that were going to be used in the as topping for this floor, which meant that the level of the finished level of the concrete had to be down by about 20 mils. And I told my foreman this, and what we should have done was rip up all the reinforcing, drop the formwork, relay the reinforcing, and then proceed. But this foreman was of the view that, look, we can just deal with this by doing a shortcut and bashing down the Rio, and it'll be right though. And my gut, everything in my gut said, no, that's not right. But I looked at him and said, he is the experienced one. He is the one that knows about this, and therefore I'll defer to his knowledge. Anyway, we went ahead with the pour, and 24 hours later, we had a big problem. And that pour had to be demolished because guess what? It was at the wrong level, and it didn't work. And so that early in my career, I had a front row seat to the implications of making mistakes and the, what that felt like, and taking responsibility. Now, thankfully, his name's John. John put his hand up and said, no, that was my issue. He sort of protected me from any implications. I was 6 months out of uni. But it was a real lesson for me that if you've got a question, if you don't understand something, if you need to ask, if it doesn't feel right, for God's sake, put your hand up and ask the question. And thankfully for me, I still remember that day. I still remember how I felt. I still remember the implications of that. And I have carried that with me all the way through. So even now, if I'm walking onto a tunnel, with a tunnel boring machine that I knew nothing about before starting this job, yes, the people in front of you know a lot more. Ask questions, because sometimes those questions are very revealing about what they know, and it helps for them to explain to somebody else what they're doing. It's almost a sanity check of what's right and wrong.
Yeah, it's a real balance, isn't it? That it's a great story, by the way. I can almost picture you wet behind your ears and in that type of environment. And it's, you know, particularly, you know, and we've grown up in environments to be very respectful of the veteran and the, you know, the person who's got the experience in regard to that. And that idea of deferring to and not ever expressing or not bringing your view. You know, there's a wonderful idea, and I talk about it a fair bit, which is from Rick Rubin, the music producer. I've spoken to you about him before, where he talks about your idea versus best idea. The goal is to get to the best idea. So if you don't bring your idea, we can't get to best idea. Otherwise, if we don't, because it's just then the assumption that the most experienced person or the person with the most expertise is the one who will always have the best idea, whereas there's no history of that. And even if it, you know, even if it just gives us reassurance that, you know, the person with the most experience, you know, that idea does stack up, you know, that's, and I very much grew up in that environment that all knowledge, you know, sat with, you know, these larger than life folk or figures in the game. And And one of the great experiences in all of that was realizing and seeing when they were wrong and their response to being wrong. You know, so for instance, Ron Barresi would own his mistakes in 2 seconds, and he would own it not because of he's always had this belief that it wasn't making him lesser. Whereas I think a lot of people of that generation that saw them as being lesser by and somehow losing respect in regard to that, but there was no loss of respect. In fact, it was a building of trust, and the building of trust was that I still want you to bring your ideas into the room. I'd never thought of it in the context of that at the time, and even ideas around gut feel are really important because, and I'll be interested in your take on gut feel as a leader. But gut feel is basically it's actually some part of you referencing some experience you've had to actually say, well, hang on, this doesn't feel right here. We think of it, you might feel it in your gut rather than in the, the more cognitive aspects of it. But there was some part of you in that moment, which was even with your inexperience, was saying, hang on, this is not right. But if you really dug in, it's not right. It's not feeling right because of some study you've done, some experience you've had, you're fresh from your course, you talked about it in your program, whatever it might be. There is that aspect to it. So the great leaders are people who are really comfortable with their errors. And it was a great experience was to back yourself in, but there was also the recognition from the person themselves that they said, yeah, hang on, I made a blue here.
Well, it's a much richer experience. And as I progressed in my career, I remember I lived in Asia and worked in Asia for a long time. I had an experience in Malaysia that was counter that because I learned we're lucky enough to live in a country here where people care about their own safety. They are innovative. To tap into people's thoughts and ideas is an amazing thing because everyone has them. In fact, one of the values that we talk about in John Holland is being imaginative, and we deliberately use that value because rather than being clever or being smart or those sort of adjectives, everybody has an imagination. And all we're asking is for people to express their thoughts and ideas, no matter how silly they are, because that's how things get done.
Yeah, bring them into the room. Bring your imagination into the room.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I think about, you talked about being in the arena and a concept for that and talked about the Allianz Stadium. One of the things that the company did to win that project was revisit a number of different design items that the client had given to us and said, here's the stadium, can you build that? And the team tapped into their imagination and changed several things about the span of the steel, about the way the precast was being done, and therefore got a solution that was not only safer, but faster and less cost. And without giving them license to express their imagination, we wouldn't have got there. Because my big lesson is everybody has this imagination. You just need to let it come out. I was challenged by that when I went to Asia, though, because all Asian cultures are different, obviously, but they are. There's some similarities in terms of speaking out and being deferential to your boss. So I remember as a being relatively experienced project manager saying to my team about a job that we were doing, it was a roof that we were constructing. And my idea was to pre-assemble the roof on the ground and lift it up to the structure. And if I'd had that conversation in Australia, there would have been people jumping in and saying, no, that won't work because that's a good idea. And we can do this at the other. And you imagine yourself around a group just standing together talking about how you would do that. My experience in Asia, was pretty much that's your idea and no one adding into that, that idea to build on it. Because unless you can tap into people's, comfortableness with expressing their ideas. And it's quite countercultural for people to do that in the Asian culture because the boss knows better. And they don't want to speak up and express that. So on my journey, I found that, you know, as Australians, we have a really rich culture that allows that sort of experience to occur and for us to be able to tap into anybody that has an idea. We're using their imagination.
And I would say that would probably also be a condition you've created as well, so that it wouldn't be universal. But I think it's probably more reflective of our culture, as in there is more of a put your hand up mindset, less hierarchical in that sense. And then you then draw deeper into that because you see the value of it. And there's a couple of things came to mind. It actually put you as a leader at risk because your style of leadership coming into that environment is probably such that you would think people would step into the space if they felt that what you were doing was wrong. So you're not hearing that. And so the chances of a worse outcome aren't just the limitation of your imagination, but it's also the fact that, you know, you may have, you know, you're used to having other people say, what about this idea? What about that idea? So if you're, you know, a not fully formed idea from your perspective could find itself to a fully formed idea at a speed and without the type of, you know, the person, you know, no devil's advocate, no one actually throwing their thoughts, their ideas into it. So your less than fully formed idea could become a formed idea way too quickly. And so there's two sort of levels of danger in all of that, the way that I see it. And you know, and even I've had that experience when, say, you're appointing a coach and you say, well, we've got a coach, but the coach is not going to be someone who's actually that prepared to listen to anyone else, but they're a very good coach. And so you're basically aligning all aspects of your organization to that person's view. And you just hope that you want him to be right. You know, you don't want him to get it wrong, that's for sure.
Which is a risk. If you are absolutely adamant that your way is the right way, then sure, you've got a chance of success if it is. Yeah. But it rarely is, right? And you are enriched by other people's ideas. And I think the trick is to be able to understand from someone in my position, when an idea comes your way, is that a good idea? How do you make sure that that idea is worthwhile progressing? Because in this industry, if you make a mistake, it's a multi-million-dollar mistake. It's a massive mistake.
Yeah.
And very, very public too, right?
More and more so now, isn't it? You've probably seen how it's always been public, but it's become extreme in that sense. The way that we sit in judgment of infrastructure projects and all that sort of stuff from our position stuck in traffic jams it's really elevated in the last couple of decades from that perspective.
Yes. Yeah. No, there's a lot of focus on it from the public point of view. Mm. Social media doesn't help because there is, anyone can post something online that says, this thing hasn't moved for X amount of time.
Yeah, exactly.
There's always logical reasons for that, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I think embracing that is a good thing. So again, in the stadium example, that was a really obvious the thing about infrastructure, a lot of it's underground. You're building tunnels, people can't perhaps see it. But when you're building a stadium and, you know, everyone knows it's got to be completed in a certain period of time, it's obvious when you're succeeding and not.
And if you get it wrong, the season doesn't start. So definitely tricky. So that idea of, you know, creating conditions and, you know, the transition from someone who encouraged the imaginations of others, it's just a really, I think there's a really simple way of thinking about it, that you only ever bring one set of eyes, one set of ears, and only one imagination into the room. And regardless of, you know, your place in some form of hierarchy, some form of structure, is that limitation always exists for you. But the decision has to land somewhere, doesn't it? At some point, you do have to to make a call. How did you find yourself, particularly the stress related to that aspect of it? And we're talking, so what's the most expensive project you've been involved with? Just so I can give people a context on the numbers that we're talking here. There's something when you're doing now, probably, but what's going on
there? Yeah, there's two that we're doing now in Melbourne, and they are both just under $10 billion.
Right.
And that's Melbourne Metro and the Westgate Tunnel in Melbourne.
Yeah. And not without their issues, either of them.
Not without their issues. It is extraordinary the numbers involved in those projects.
Yeah.
And somebody told me the difference between a million and a billion. That was fascinating, but it scared me quite a lot. To count to a million, let me get this right in terms of
the timing,
yeah. Okay, so to count to 1 million takes you 11 days and 13 hours. To count to a billion takes you 31 years and 8 months.
It's just so taking me in a billion now, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, when I'm reviewing those projects, I'm really focusing on the zeros, right? Because
there's lots.
I was going to get the billions wrong, but it just the enormity of it. It's amazing. So yeah, in a field, a project like the stadium is around about $700-800 million, the top end of the scale with a massively complicated infrastructure project like a Melbourne Metro, where you're tunneling underneath the city for 11 kilometres and putting stations and commissioning a railway, et cetera, is at that 10 billion end. So our average size is probably closer to 600-700 million.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And obviously the margin for error is such, I assume that the percentages operate the same, that you, if you make a 1% mistake in any of your calculations, well, you've just added 31 years of counting onto three years.
Exactly. Well, the complexity of these projects is enormous, and in recent times, because we've just gone through a huge infrastructure boom, big project in the industry 8-9 years ago would have been a billion and a half, massive project. Now, like we, John Holland, are doing four of them over 5 billion.
Wow.
And the industry is doing that as well. And we're seeing the benefits of that in our cities. Sydney has just opened the Metro and the WestConnex projects, and that's making our city easy to get around. But the complexity of them is absolutely enormous. And there's lots of lessons learned that the industry has had over the last eight years in terms of delivering these things. Bottom line is they're not easy, and you need to deal with things when they go wrong, when the weather changes, when something doesn't turn up, when there's a program issue, COVID, for example. There's all these challenges. The wonderful thing about our industry is every day is different.
How do you cope with that? That's because you're waking up to those issues and the potentiality of any one of a million things which can go wrong each day. And I'm sure you've had your moments in terms of that. How have you learned over time to at least manage yourself through that process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've always been quite focused on a reasonable balance in my life. So I am very focused on keeping fit, eating well, sleeping well, et cetera, et cetera. So that keeps me fairly balanced. That and spending time with family is very important. So I think the way I describe it to those I work with is, in order to put in a shift, You've got to be able to do that. It's. I mean, sport is a wonderful analogy, and I do use it a lot when I talk to teams. But to play a good game, you need to be well rested. You need to be in the zone, and you need to be ready to go. You can't play a good game if you just played a game the day before that's tough. You can't do that. So for me, I'm very focused on balance and making sure I'm physically able to do the job that I have. The second thing I do is I don't say to myself, I've got to work long hours. I'm not measuring my productivity by how long I work. So people who know me know that if they're going to schedule a meeting with me in the morning, 8:30 is a good time. Why? Because I'm out on the water paddling from early and I'll do that and get myself set for the day. And if you work from 8:30 to 6, sometimes it's longer than that, but that's a good shift. And you can be productive during that shift and focused on that shift. The other aspect of that is I do have a view that there are a number of things that you simply cannot control. You can't control external events, and there's no use stressing about managing them, the inputs to those. You can only manage the outputs. So I've got this mental map of things that come into your day, the inputs that you control are the things that you can, the most valuable. When you're in the moment and you're in the dealing with the stuff that's come in already, then you can deal with that better if you've pre-prepared the inputs and then the outputs as a result of those. But I certainly don't stress about bad weather, about one of the challenges that we've had in the industry is hyper-escalation. Yeah. Wondering about that. COVID happened, it increased the supply chain issues, et cetera, and as a result of that, there was hyper-escalation. Could I control that? No. Can I manage that in terms of how I price projects moving forward? Yes. So I have this paradigm about what you can control, you can sweat about, but what you can't control, don't worry about it. You're not in control of that, and therefore that shouldn't be causing you stress. You've just got to deal with it well enough to understand the implications.
That sounds unbelievably reasonable, but so challenging to achieve. You know, I can imagine, at least in our age, that we grew up in a mindset that, leaders are first in, last out. It's an interesting thing in sport. We've really challenged for decades now ourselves to make sure that the athletes are in good shape, coming into games and that they're ready to perform. But everyone else around the athletes, were burning the candle at both ends and often in a really bad place, So, you would never expect your workers to be, they've got to live their own lives and all that sort of stuff. But I could imagine a major safety issue would be having highly fatigued, workforce, and because, poor decisions happen under fatigue, as they do under any, and stress is almost a form of fatigue in that way, it fatigues you in that way. Have you ever felt some pressure, something beyond your natural inclination there in moments of stress to set that stuff aside and just say, look, I'm going to try and outwork this problem, or you've been able to maintain that mindset throughout, like for example, during COVID where, we were actually in the same room where all of a sudden, the reality of COVID, hit us. It was with, as you remember, Richard Goyder, who was, chairman of ANZET, the AFL and Woodside. And all of a sudden this thing, it was just days away from appearing or becoming real when they actually cancelled the Grand Prix in Melbourne. That's when it really became obvious, and that was just a few days away. And I'm sure that you were sitting there thinking, gee, how's this going to work for us? We've got these two massive, or at least those two massive infrastructure projects well underway or definitely in plan. How do you respond in that moment? Because you're asked to leave, that, really, aren't you?
Yeah, no, you are. And I think, to me, if I recall that moment, We in this industry and we as a company do a lot of joint ventures with other companies. And a lot of them are from Europe, the Spanish in particular. And at that moment, we were looking over to Europe, and a lot of the European governments and a lot of the European construction companies were actually shutting down their jobs because of this COVID wave. You remember Italy was particularly a problem early days. And we looked at the industry and they were stopping projects. Their mentality was, you can't work. You've got to separate. We can't do that. So how, I guess my mindset in that was, again, look at the inputs. How do we control that? Do we know enough about COVID? And we all learned over time about what it was. But we actually engaged. I knew enough to know that the fundamentals of our economy, 1 in 10 workers works in the construction, property, and building industry.
So 1 in 10.
1 in 10. People who manufacture for the industry, steel, concrete, plasterboard, et cetera, glass, and then in the building and property industry, 1 in 10 people in this country work to support that.
No idea.
So knowing that and knowing the importance of that to our economy was important when we engaged government. And government knew that as well. Because you can imagine, if our industry shut down, not only would the project not continue and that would be terrible for the companies, but from a government point of view, it would mean that you would have people not earning income, not spending money, being on benefits, etc. It'd be absolutely massive. So one thing that we did was we engaged with the government, and I was lucky enough to be on the task force that was dealing with this. It was at the time when the stadium was being built as well. And it's amazing when you think back at it, because at that stage, we hadn't heard of a COVID test. At that stage, you had to go and do a PCR test that would take, you know, a long time to get processed.
Yeah.
So we began looking at other industries to look at what was being trialed in other industries, and we came up with these rapid tests, and that would seem groundbreaking at the time. Now you can walk into a chemist and get one.
Yeah.
But we just engaged with the government to talk about how we would keep on going and how we could be safe. And one thing that this industry is great on is managing safety. The industry, it can be a very, very dangerous industry. You work at heights, you've got electricity, et cetera, but the actual records of the industry is quite good at protecting people. So we knew that there were systems, procedures and processes to manage that. And then we said to the government, look, we can do this, because if there's separation between people, we can bring in all these different standards and ways of working that enable that to happen. And that's exactly what they did. They believed that we could do it. The unions were a big part of that. So traditionally, there's a bit of tension between the unions and the construction companies. But at that stage, we said our common goal is to keep people working. And it was quite amazing how actually transformed the way we all thought about how the industry could keep going, when a lot of other industries were being crippled by having to work from home, et cetera, et cetera. Because that wasn't an option in an industry. You've got to be on.
Can't work from home, no. It's a great story. There's a couple of things come to mind. The first one is just a good plan, like understanding what you can control. The first thing which comes to mind is a lot to differentiate between a complex issue and a complicated issue. Like, a complex issue is the one which really has no answer, you know, highly ambiguous, often as it relates to the dynamics of an organization, how people are relating, how our team connects, how our team, you know, trusts and works together and gives up a piece of themselves for someone else, that sort of dynamic piece.
Yeah.
Whereas the complicated issue is mostly the mechanics, the system. And it seems that it had all the appearance of a complex issue, but you addressed it as a complicated issue. We do have systems here. We do have structures. We do have uncertainty, no doubt. But given our track record and the things that we've done over a whole period of time, is that we have faced into, you know, significant safety issues and found solutions in the past. And let's just address this as one of those, with all the lack of insight and lack of knowledge that we actually had at that particular time. And in doing so, you then made the solution compelling enough for people to support it. And which is the second idea which comes to mind, is that all good planning, all good strategy needs to come from a compelling story. You had to make it compelling enough for, and then the second part is you would have to have made trade-offs. We can't do all the things that we used to be able to do. We're going to have to change some things here. We're probably going to be less effective than what we were, but at least, you know, the machine keeps working. The machine keeps, you know, digging that tunnel in the meantime. And so I think there's a couple of ideas which come into that idea of trying to differentiate between a complex issue, complicated issue. Complicated issue normally does have a solution. We just got to try and find it. Complex, yeah. That's a leadership judgment issue. Yeah. And then good strategy comes from a compelling story, makes good trade-offs. Yeah.
Now, it's a really good way of thinking about it. No, I actually haven't thought about it in that light before. And I guess, if I think about one of the things that I was very, very keen on doing when I began at John Holland, I knew we were, to use your language, working in a complicated industry. It's wonderful what we create. They're difficult, right? Tunneling under a city, building a railway line, putting a water system through a city, they're all very complicated things. So one of the things that I was very keen on doing when I joined on John Holland is I'm a big believer in purpose in an organization, and you get a discretionary effort if you have people attached to that purpose and believe that they are making a difference. So I entered the organization with that mindset of being genuine and being yourself and being curious, but also knowing in all my experience that you needed to have a purpose about the organization that people could connect to. So we did this, all of the projects I've done at John Holland amazing. You know, whether it's building hospitals or complicated roads or stadia or metros, etc. One of the ones I'm most proud of is the project that we did around purpose and our values and building our brand. And the purpose, we sort of had, you know, conventionally you talk to clients about what they think about the company, you talk to employees, etc. And we came up through a series of workshops about this theme that everything we did was transforming the city, was transforming the economy that we're in, and was transforming people's way of getting to work and coming home from work, etc. Whether it be improving the water quality, improving the health through building a hospital, whatever. So we came up with this concept of the purpose was to transform lives. And that became a very, very deep connection with everybody who works with us. We have this Facebook page called Workplace, which is brilliant. And in our industry particularly, because people post photos of what they're doing, milestones, et cetera, and the theme of transforming lives really comes out of that. So we came up with that theme, and then we came up with a set of values that were expansive in terms of the way we thought about what we're doing. Imaginative being one of them, caring being one of them, future focused being one of them. And I always remember sitting, being really proud of that work and thinking, wow, we've got some fantastic values, we've got a great purpose. At the time, we were owned by our new owners. They're relatively new, the Chinese. And the Chinese loved the logo that we used to have, which is quite a, you look at the logo, it's a very arcane logo, sort of engineering in the way it looked at the square, but they loved the red bit of it. So I worked with this design organization to do all that stuff about purpose and brand and values and so on and so forth. But I'd said to them, don't change the logo too much because our owners really like it and they're quite precious about it. So we'd done all this work, and I went to this meeting where they unveiled the logo. It was this big sort of unveiling of the logo. And you can imagine all these people with very creative minds who were very excited about the logo drop. And when they pulled down the sheet of paper that revealed the logo, I remember looking at it and thinking, that's disappointing. Because I was really, my expectation about the purpose and the values and what people were thinking was let down by the physical manifestation of that logo that they created.
There's a mismatch.
Yeah, because when the beginning of that journey, I'd said to them, don't change the logo. The logo shouldn't change. And sure enough, they listened to me. So in that moment, I actually said to them, okay, guys, I think what I've done is analogous to this. I think what I've said to you is design an opera house in Sydney on the beautiful harbour, but don't make it stand out and don't make it, fancy and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So I think what I've said to you is just put a square box on the harbour and have it very functional on the inside, because that's what we want. We're very clear about what we want. So they sort of nodded, and you can see the creative types in the room thinking, yeah, that's exactly what you did. You constrained us. So then I said to them, go for it. You tell me, with all this brand and transforming lives and everything else, that you tell me what logo we should have. And 3 weeks later, I was in the same room and they unveiled the new logo, and it was one of the most emotional moments I've had in the company. And if you look at our company's logo, the company's called John Holland, and all they did was put the O of the John above the A of the Holland, and in between the O and the A, put a line that made that bit look like a human being.
Yeah, that's.
And our logo today has this human being in the middle of John Holland.
Yes.
And it resonates so well because it matches the values, because it gives a meaning to it, and because it provides a purpose that people can connect to. And I, one of my favorite parts of my job is walking onto a project, people explaining what they're doing and giving them license to do that. But you can feel that they understand that purpose.
Yeah.
It's like when Kennedy walked into NASA and said to the guy sweeping the corridor, what are you doing? And instead of saying, the guy saying, I'm just sweeping the corridor to get it clean for the president, he said, I'm helping put a man on the moon. Because his purpose was to have that wider aim. So one of the things, to go back to that complex thing, our industry is complex, but I find that giving people a purpose, giving them a license to do what they do, it just gives a such a depth to what you can achieve, because people are amazing, what they can think of, what they do, and it doesn't require anything more than just showing them that it can be done and giving them that purpose.
That's a great story. It is, again, and every time you say something, a few things come to mind. The first one is the being a CEO and being a leader, probably, or a senior leader, or any form of leader, is your capacity to almost—it's almost the intersection of contradictions at different times. This idea: you want to respect the heritage, you want that because that's important, but you also want to create something new and exciting, and those two places. And ultimately, you've got to put, you're either going to stay on the pier or get on the boat. You can't sort of have a foot in both. But when you get on the boat, you also want to know, who's the skipper, how far you could swim, because you might be jumping in, So all of those sort of factors then come into play. And there was a great line, which is, and I can't remember exactly what it was. It came up in the Shane McCurry podcast where he talked about this idea of, that tradition isn't about raking over the ashes. It's about, preserving the flame or preserving the fire or whatever it might be. And I really like that idea that, and particularly, from a sport point of view, we love our heritage. We love our folklore. We love the heroes who have gone before us. We love to give respect to the shoulders which we stand on. But each generation, each iteration of team, each iteration of success is going to be very, very different. Yes, there'll be people wearing black and yellow jumpers or blue and white hoops or whatever it might be, but each iteration is certainly different. And being able to hold the two things in balance as a leader, the heritage of it, the so far story, which has made us, but also build a really compelling not yet story is just a, and that gives you the excitement, and people need that. They want to know they're a part of something, but they're also part of the future as well.
You know, people don't know what they don't know, right? Because if I think about that process, there are John Holland is a 70-year-plus company, and there's a wonderful heritage. John Holland, in the sporting context, built the Great Southern Stand for and when we went about that process that I was talking about, there was a lot of people and a real concern that don't change that heritage, don't change that brand, don't change what we stand for. We've done great stuff. Don't mess with it. And that's what our owners said to me. That's what our people said to me. But I guess my view is, again, maybe it goes back to your gut feeling, that people can be inspired by change if you allow them to be inspired by that change and not threatened by it. And if you allow them to be part of the process of that change, they will come with you. They will go with that. And they won't resist it. But you've got to allow them to be part of that. So part of that was working groups and what do you think about that, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember being absolutely delighted by feedback from, again, a trusty old supervisor on a project. And he had said to me, don't change the logo, more or less. And a few weeks after the launch of our logo, he was proudly wearing a new John Holland T-shirt with a human being in the middle of it saying, mate, thank you so much. I've been working for this company for 15 years. I'm going to work for another 15 years because I just love this place and you've made it tick. And that, if you can tap into that, it's amazing. But I guess my lesson into that is don't be afraid of making change, because most people will tell you it can't be done or it's dangerous or there's risk involved in it. And you've got to be measured and understanding what you change, but don't be afraid of it, because if you don't change, you won't succeed.
Yeah, that's a great story, and I really encourage leaders to tap into this idea that the other thing which I thought about was that your recognition that you hadn't nailed it as well. It would have been easy. It was like with a concrete pour, where, everyone could have ducked for cover, there's probably a whole lot of people in this who are respectful of you. Yeah, even the creatives involved in this, because, I'm sure there's nothing a creative hates more than a CEO, I reckon, where you just go, they're trying to do too many things, or that they're reluctant to change, whichever way, they want it to say too many things, or, they don't want it to say anything, because you're putting it out to the world. It's almost like your infrastructure projects, in many ways, they're out to the world. And I'm sure there's design elements in that which are unbelievably thoughtful in that sense. But this one is the one that people are going to see all the time. And, it is, a couple of AFL clubs have changed their logos recently, and you can just see it's going to divide opinion straight away, because people are very embedded in the way that they think of their club. And
longer history and everything that means. I mean, I think my absolute way of approaching that was to say, this is about purpose. This is about meaning, rather than viewing it as it's just a logo or it doesn't really mean anything. So one thing I did do is I really leant into it, and people understood this is my project. I'm really close to this. I care about this, rather than having a team that was going to do the rebranding.
Yeah.
And I think that made a difference, because people
would have made a huge difference. It would have made a bad difference as well. You could have run interference if that was your mindset as well. And it seems that you didn't do that.
I think as you run through your career, you become more learned about these things. So my whole mindset in joining John Holland was be quite deliberate about what I'm doing, be genuine, be inquisitive, be everything else. but make a difference. And that culture aspect of that purpose has been quite an amazing journey about leaning into culture. And we spoke about safety before, but I'm also a big believer that well-being, well, certainly in our industry, the construction industry is one of the poorest industries for mental health, and it's got a very, very bad rate of suicide connected with the industry. There's a lot of mental health challenges in our society, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things we did was actually lean into that and understand that safety is a direct implication of lots of different things. But back to those inputs, we need to care about people and tell them we're caring about people in order for them to be safe. So what does that look like? Provide more water on the spots. Get them involved in talking about how they're going to do an activity rather than tell them. Deal with them as people who you understand have stresses in their lives outside of work, etc. So again, in a neat little intersection with the sporting world, we are working with actually the St Kilda Football Club who have the Danny Frawley Centre. And we have sent, this is our second year of sending people to the Danny Frawley Centre, and their supervisors and people on the front line to deal and, with mental health, to talk to them about their own mental health, and give them tools, both cognitively and from a physical point of view, to make their life easier. And it's been very, very successful. We're now replicating that across the country, tapping into that, to that centre.
Yeah. Well done. But just even having, you can't put care as a value and then not recognize and understand what that asks of you in that sense. You know, that particularly when, you know, there's an obvious measurement is that we are in an industry which has a very high suicide rate. And all of these things are, you know, so this is a complex issue, you know, in that definition that we talk to. But if you're not prepared to face into it, you know, that, you know, so even as leaders, I go, well, you know, that I think there's, we're makers and you make things. That's what you do. That's what the business has done for 70 plus years. So, but as a leader, I think of sort of four domains of making. And the first one is we've got to be able to make sense of issues such as this. We need to be able to make sense of, you know, we do have too many people in our industry who are in a poor place in terms of their mental health, and that's playing out in the most, you know, challenging and almost catastrophic way, if you like, if someone loses a family member to suicide.
And there's a, I guess going back to one of my big beliefs coming into this job was about purpose, but it was also in saying it was about how. Because the industry is dominated by a number of players that are excellent putting stuff together.
Yeah.
To me, what I understood there was an opportunity to do was talk about, yes, it's the what, but how we do that. And that how bit was about empowering people and about genuinely saying we care about you. And my view is that people, individuals, can sniff out a person who's not genuine very quickly.
Particularly on the insight, I would imagine.
Well, because it's a wonderful industry because you are not you're not in a boardroom or you're not in an office environment where hierarchy's more. You're there with a high-vis shirt on, a hat, et cetera, and your first name. And so you've got this beautiful rawness about how you talk to people and how they talk to you. And that, going back to my early years of experience, dealing with the foreman, dealing with the carpenters and steel fixers, et cetera, they're real people. And if you are not genuine with them, then you won't get anything. You won't get productivity, you won't get ideas, you won't get innovation, and you won't get a safe building site as a result. Because if you say that you are, you're worried about safety and you're going to do X, Y, and Z, but they think he doesn't care, then it's not going to work. I can imagine it's the same on the football field, right?
If you, the environment. Yeah. Because the term we use is, you know, it's a really simple one, is that people don't experience our intentions, they experience our behaviours. So are you behaving in a way which matches the intention you speak to? So if you put care up as a value, you know, tell me the behaviours that we're seeing as an organisation in regard to that. And so that's the, you know, and then the next making I think of is, you know, making of meaning. It's got to mean that something to people. This has got to, you know, it's got to, we're going to ask people to spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week in our environment for one reason or another. Can actually be really meaningful for them. And hence an alignment to purpose is a critical element of that. And which then goes to that next idea of making of place, you know, it's to say people, you belong here. This is part of you, to have, you know, have a foreman, a 15-year foreman, you know, tap his chest and say, yeah, I love this logo and I'm going to be here for 15 years. Why? Because you belong here. This is part of who you are. And you only get the sense-making, the place-making and the meaning-making is if you're prepared to make space as a leader, having the conversations that we need to be able to have to make sure that we're doing those things. And so you come into the role not as someone who's just going to build stadiums, but someone who wants to align, build. Let it start with a deeper sense of purpose, and that takes time and space and effort, and it's not a top down exercise as much as you can easily make it that.
Yeah, it's got to be. You got to tap into what people want. And another example on that line is the industry, because of the issues I've talked about, needs to change and shift, and that issue of being present has been very dominant in our industry. You turn up at 7, you finish late, it's all everyone on. So one of the things that that we did was introduce this concept of flexibility. It's often talked about, but and our young graduates obviously get it. They don't want to work long 4 hours they want to have time with their family and friends and to have life outside of it. But it's that subset of people in our industry, the supervisors, the foremen, that have been in the industry for a long time, that did work long hours. To me, telling them the story about their own flexibility is very powerful. So when we introduce we have this thing called the flexibility wheel, saying to people, look, we don't want you to work long hours. We want you to be geared up to be productive, but have a life outside of work. And one of the big breakthroughs I found was, again, talking to that subset of people, because I remember a conversation with a foreman, and he was telling me that the flexibility was bullshit because he wanted the engineers to work long hours, he had to, et cetera, et cetera. So I just said to him, mate, so what are you doing outside work? And eventually he told me about his family and so on and so forth. And I said, how are your kids? And he said, 15 and 12. And I said, do they do sport on the weekends? He said, yeah. I said, you get out to many games? He said, no, because I'm at work. I said, mate, that's what I want to do. I want you to get you on the side of the football field, to see your son, go and play. And this guy was one of those sticklers for working hard and being very, I guess traditional in the sense that we might have been brought up in. But he emailed me later on and he said to me, thank you. Mm-hmm. My wife thanks me. My children thank you. You've made a big, big difference to how I view life. The other thing on that flexibility.
It's powerful.
It's powerful. We introduce a parental policy, parental leave. And I didn't know this, and I wasn't really responsible for this, but my corporate affairs team, first, parental leave was obviously for the dads as well as the mums. So we introduce a long period of time for the dads to enjoy being a new father. Mm-hmm. And the corporate affairs team sent them, every time we have a John Holland baby, they send them a onesie with that John Holland logo on it. And it sounds bad, but they ask our employees to send me an email with a photo of their beautiful baby in a onesie. And it's so good. I get these emails from people who are genuinely appreciative of the fact that they've got some time. But, wow, there's this beautiful baby in a John Holland onesie. It's really nice.
Fantastic. And interesting, one of the questions I ask leaders in that sense is just answer the question, how will you know? How will you know? You know, there's, yeah, and like the things on track, the things where it should be, you know, what are going to be the signs? And, yeah, our first thought is to go to data, you know, that, you know, the thing's running on time, you know, the numbers are coming in or whatever it might be. But my experience of the how will you know is exactly the stories you've told. It's the photos. It's the running into someone 10 years after the event and they relay a conversation that you had with them that you have very, if no memory of, but certainly very little memory of it, but that conversation was, you know, really very important for them. And in the midst of all the nonsense that we deal with and the reflections you actually have, I mean, there's actually one, and this guy would, I don't even know if he'd remember it, it just came to mind then. I was at Fremantle as CEO, and there was a guy by the name of Robbie Hadrill who played with us, and Robbie was a smallish key back who just was a terrific player. And he came in, had some injury issues, came in, and then really just looked like he was going to have a long-term career, but the knees just got the better of him, and he might have played 30 games in the end. He was a massive opportunity cost, like in all forms. I reckon he could have ended up being a team leader. We actually were one fullback short. That was the other thing, which happens, of course, and they're hard to find. And he was just a terrific young guy. And when I left Frio years later, his time had come, and years later, but he got a series of letters. One of them was from Robbie Hadrill, just thanking me. And I can't remember having a heap of conversations with him. When you're at Frio, you travel with the team a bit, so it might have been in all of that stuff, but it was really heartfelt. And they're the things that I still think about, that he's a guy who would have every reason to be pretty bitter on the game, I think, you know, that it probably cost him a couple of $3 million, the injuries that he had. And he might have actually been the difference at some point between Fremantle winning it and not winning it, you know, because that's such an important role to play in a team structure. But he found the time to write this letter, and I've never forgotten that. And so in 30 years in the game, you deal with a lot of footballers, and yeah, there's probably four or five who have made that effort. And so just even bringing that in and having that encouragement, that what we do is we share the most profound moments of our entire life, like having a baby is like, right, you know, it's up there in the biggest things ever going to happen. But in that moment, I'm going to actually share it with the CEO of the organization. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and again, it's a genuineness, and I've had that similar experience recently with people reflecting on conversations that, yes, to be quite frank, you know, many different conversations with many different people. And I always say to people, look, you know, there's in John Holland, there's 6,500 people. I'm going to give it a good crack at remembering people's names. But you're often blown away by the power of those conversations. Again, and all it takes is you asking them, how you doing? What are you working on? How do you think about this? Can I get your thoughts on that? And that's gold. It's amazing.
It's a different approach, though. That's not g'day, how are you going, mate? Yeah, good. That's not the conversation you're having. You're encouraging those who have at least an appetite for this conversation to go to a place that they wouldn't normally go. You know, whereas our first, you can be friendly and decent and all those sorts of things, but that's not engaging in. Now, I always found the best way to engage was having a real insight into the work they're doing and the challenges that they face.
Yeah, no, that is the other thing. I think you've got to be considerate about what you're doing. So, I was on a project the other day and an amazing job underneath Sydney Airport in Mascot. They're building out what they call a micro tunnel to run services underneath the ground. And the team there had done something really clever on the innovation space. Yeah. But I knew about what they had done, but I was inquisitive about how they came up with it. So I think you're right. You need to know enough about what they're doing and have a depth of conversation with them, not just a service level conversation that says, I know what you're doing, I value it, I'm really keen to understand more. But all that's got to be wrapped up in a, but just being genuine, because it makes people stay. You think about yourself, right? If people ask you, how you doing when you walk past them, okay, that's fine. But if people generally saying, ask you about yourself in a way that shows that they care about you, is because people don't, you know, you experience it yourself. It makes a big difference.
No, it's huge. It is, because it is just, it actually, we're lazy. That's part of it. And we're often distracted. That's the other thing. Yeah. If you just stop, you know, you might have a conversation with whoever is the CEO saying, we put a big investment into our technology and all the football data and all of that sort of stuff. And it's actually, I know you build these great stadiums, but putting data into stadiums is actually hard because of, you know, just the, and you'll deal with this a million times, I'm sure. And we're having all these challenges for the first iteration of this that we can't get things to talk to each other. And that's actually really quite stressful halfway through a third quarter, you know, when the game's on and the coaches can't access the data.
Yes.
And so it tends to, the first mindset is to go to a place of blame. And in my experience, blame is a really easy place to go and it finds friends easily, but offers not one solution like ever. So, you know, and I remember it was after a game and he's just one of our young guys. It was just, you know, really the problem rested with him. But a bit like you were talking about before, there's a lot of things he couldn't control, you know, but it was all, you know, just fix it, mate, sort of mindset going on. And I remember just having this long conversation with him after the game and he just broke down crying, the poor bloke. And, you know, it literally was, we lose the game, he's blaming himself and all that. Well, we lost the game because we're no good, not because the data didn't come through. So, you know, that's, let's be fair. But just in the stress of the moment, the emotion of the moment, the heights of it all, and then I caught up with him during the week and they'd made a few little things. This sounds like progress, mate. That sounds good. And anyway, it was fixed in a couple of weeks. You know, it was sorted.
Yeah.
I actually ran into this guy about 3 weeks ago and he said, remember that convo we had, you know, after, and he couldn't believe that I remembered it, but he's gone on to great things. He's young guy.
Well, how you act in that moment is really important, right? If you do blame, that will be remembered. But if you were generous in spirit to go beyond that and be big, the other thing I often think about is just being big, being bigger than
being big.
Just be big, right? So if you in that moment that you're talking about, you can blame, you can get angry, you can undo all sorts of things. Yeah. But if you step outside of that and say what's really important and try and be that person, then it makes a world of difference. And to me, the concept of being big is in every facet, right? Because whether you're after a long day, whether you're tired, whether you're hungry, whether you need another coffee, whatever, being big doesn't cost you much. But it's quite often important to focus on that, to say what's the bigger conversation here, bigger in generosity, bigger in terms of finding out what people are thinking and what makes them tick. I find it's almost like a muscle memory of being able to be in that mode. You then don't think about blaming the software or the IT or whatever. You just say, yeah, okay, if that happens, then I'll deal with it differently.
Well, that's outstanding. We often talk about. And I have these conversations. You've met Cecily, my wife, who's a clin psych, and the difference between emotions and feelings and which are which, you know, when emotions become feelings, that type of thing, is the thing we coach to and talk to a lot. And you've really touched on some wonderful ones. Like you talk about the moment a lot, you know, about who you are in that moment, and really even having a strong sense of purpose gives you a context for who you should be in that moment. But just having, you know, we really can't trust our feelings a lot of the time, because our feelings take us down to places where probably for reasons of evolution, that the human behavior actually served us well at some stage of evolutionary history, but doesn't serve us very well in modern life, you know. And you know, one of my great mentors, Ron Bresci, I mentioned you before, said that, you know, as the great players are better than human nature. And I think there's an element of leadership which you have to manage your human nature in those moments. And so your little system that you're using is almost a principle in that moment. So you learn to trust your principles when you can't trust your feelings, where your feelings are probably wanting to take you to a place of blame or anger or, you know, or disappointment or criticism. But again, no future in those things. So you say, just be big. You just, what would a be big leader do in this moment? You know,
that's a great saying that you talked about with Bresci, better than human nature. It's the same sort of concept, I think. Mm. And to do that, I find that you know, as you get more experienced, knowing yourself is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Knowing and being comfortable with yourself is a wonderful gift you can give yourself, because if you take a moment to think about your reactions and with a mix with experience, it'll always be a better outcome, because the immediate human response of getting angry or blame or whatever, or getting a bit antsy, is going to be a negative experience for you, and more so for people in the room, because things always go wrong, right? You know, whether it's the IT thing or project going bad or whatever, you can't condone poor performance. So there is a balance between recognizing that performance is poor, projects being behind schedule, and there are moments where you say, okay, the human dynamic here isn't working, so you might have to change out people. Again, you have to back yourself into that decision. But knowing yourself and knowing how you're going to react to things is a pretty good gift that you can give yourself.
And you can work on it, you know. And I started all that too late. That I, in many ways, I thought there was a certain expectation how leaders behave, and you almost create these identities and try to fit into when. Much easier just to be yourself, but be yourself with, yeah, having done the work on what yourself is, you know, what are the things that are important to you in that way. So you give yourself the best chance of behaving to those intentions in the moments that matter. And it's interesting, even in this conversation now, we haven't talked much about, you know, the technical capability you bring or all of the other rich experiences. We've actually, majority of the conversation has been about you, leader, how you respond in the moments that matter. You know, whether it was, you know, the pouring of concrete, whether it was by the side of the rail line in WA, it's how you respond in moments, because that's how people experience you. You know, that's how, you know, that's, you're only, you know, we're measured by a whole lot of things, but the main thing we're measured by is how we show up, you know, how we show up to this interview now, how we show up, you know, to our family when we get home, how we show up, you know, to, you know, I know that you're now also, you know, you're the parent of an AFLW player, Nicola, you know, there's, you know, it's a different experience again for you in terms of that, you know, I would imagine, you know, how you parent in when she's going through her own challenges in that scenario.
That experience of having grown, I've got three daughters, and as you say, Nicola's the AFLW player. Having your kids get to the age where they are mature, they know themselves well enough to know their frailties and so on, but they also know you well enough to know your frailties and make fun of you and all that sort of stuff. But lean on you for advice or ask you questions that make you feel good in yourself is a very rich conversation. So, yeah, the conversations I've had with my daughters about whether it be finance or what they do, how to buy a house or how to make a decision, and it's wonderful. It really is.
Imagine this. Did it help coming from? I think you come from a family of six, didn't you? You got plenty of siblings. Yeah.
I'm one of six kids, and classically, I'm in the middle, so I've got two older sisters, me, and then my younger brother and sisters. So I always felt blessed with my upbringing because, you know, it's a big family. Mum and Dad both worked. I went to school in St. Kilda, I always remember going to university and thinking, wow, not everybody goes to a Catholic school.
Almost the six years wasn't an accident, but that all probably wasn't.
Yeah, exactly.
There was nothing working against it, put it that way.
Exactly, yeah. But it was a great upbringing where there was the key ingredients of being successful in the way that you measure success, whether it be, to me, it's are you happy? Are you challenged? Are you pushing yourself, et cetera? Mm. And to me, that experience of growing up in a time when we didn't have social media and all those sort of pressures, was great. It was a rich experience growing up, and then certainly coming into my early career, I learned that, there's a wider world out there that I hadn't experienced before, and you do need to equip yourself for it. But that's where I was referring to that stress bit in my early career. And one of the other things I often think about is stress is the difference between your natural state and the state you are purporting to be.
Just run that one past me again. So stress is the difference.
So
you go into a gap,
It's a gap between your natural state, who you are, and who you are purporting to be.
That's great.
And by that, as I reflect in my career, we all do this in my career, those 40 engineers that started that were whittling down to 15, I felt as though I needed to know more, I needed to work harder, I needed to be somewhere else. I was quite stressed in those early years because, there's a time in your career where you just can't rest on asking lots of questions because, you know, you just don't feel comfortable doing it. And now, again, particularly with this John Holland job, I made a decision to say, I am who I am. I'm going to present as who I am. I'm going to run things the way I think about things. And therefore, yes, there's a lot of stress in managing a big business. Absolutely. But in myself, I don't need to purport to be anybody else to my shareholders, to the board, to my leadership team, to the people on the projects, to clients. Just be yourself. And therefore, you don't have to game plan things because it's a zero stress state.
And that's how I've experienced you. It wasn't until you really pointed it out then that there's a lovely, it might come across as confidence, but it's almost comfort in what and who you are and what you bring and not having, there's no, there's a wonderful line, and I've shared this with you, coming from the Neil Craig podcast, is that we all need a performance ego. But we also have to have a quiet ego as well. And so the performance ego is not all eyes on you. It's the I've got this ego, I can handle this ego. Yeah. And then the quiet ego is you looking at the John Holland sign saying, no, that's not good enough. I think I might have not quite got that one right. If you don't have the two of them working at the same time and I think there's an early days, you think it's all about the performance ego, don't you? You think it's, you hit it. Because we all spend at least periods of our life waiting to be, waiting to be selected or waiting to be chosen. Like even in primary school when, they're picking the footy teams at lunchtime, you and there's some poor kid's going to end up last, That's sort of life in some ways.
It is life. I think it never stops, does it? But I think that bit about knowing yourself and knowing how you are. I remember early days, you think about meetings and so on. The need to say something or prove something was probably there earlier in my career. Whereas now, okay, you are gifted by your title, so that allows you to be a little bit more free about what you might express or whatever, but you also realize that comes from responsibility, that you can't just express things on a whim because that makes an impact.
Yeah, as Peter Parker's uncle told him in Spider-Man, with power comes responsibility, you know, but you know, still,
yes,
when you're quoting the comics, you know, I think it's but it is a wonderful line in that sense. But you're at the peak of your game, but you're actually moving on. So this is the thinking and the thoughts of a retiring CEO who's been, I think, naturally reflective, but perhaps you may be a little bit more reflective than normal. Would that be fair?
No, it is very true. So as you say, recently I've decided to step down from the John Holland role. But the phrase I'm using to my daughters is I'm taking a gap year. And I've got some wonderful things planned out, because I know that in myself I'm energetic enough, young enough, relatively, to do some wonderful things. I've got some great hikes planned for the first bit of next year. But I'm absolutely of a mindset that, yeah, I'll do another gig. I'll get back into it. And to give me the energy to do that, is what I need. I've been in the John Holland role for 8 years. It's been a great, privilege, to have the guardianship of the company for that long. And I'm really looking forward to, some time to explore other bits of the world, life, etc., and reflect. And it's been a lovely period of time over the last couple of months in those people, that sort of conversation that you people contacted me and saying, hey, I remember when we had this conversation, that made an impact. It's nice. It's good to reflect on that.
Yeah, and I'm sure they'll come your way. And and the time I've got to know you is certainly, yeah, that would be my reflection, that conversations we've had, and I think probably you always are drawn to, you know, that sort of CEO to CEO conversation when you get those opportunities. And
yes.
And I've really appreciated that. And as you know, I like to challenge, you were sent you a little note last night, you know, a question for me, and what comes to mind when it comes to a question for me?
Yeah, well, I've often thought about this in myself, which is why I'll ask you this, because quite often in life, you say you can be defined by your upbringing, but from a career sense of pure, as a person, we often talk about when people ask how you are. I have found myself talking about work quite a lot, because it's what I love and what I do and all the other stuff. So I guess my question to you is, you are someone that I really enjoy, learning from and talking to, and when we met was in that CEO forum. But your whole persona has been defined by your career, some of which was more family orientated because your family was in there, et cetera, the opportunities you had. But can you imagine a Cam that hadn't taken that route, and what would that Cam have done? Because I know you've got lots of talents, you're a wonderful artist, and you're now doing this very well. What other journey would you have taken, do you think, if you could step back in time and tell young Cam to take a different direction?
Yeah, and I'd say it has given me reason to reflect, because, you know, I was sacked from my role 10 years ago, and almost all aspects of my life had been defined in one way or another by the game itself. You know, fell in love with footy before pretty much anything in one way or another, and really embraced sort of being a student of the game in many ways. And then, you know, facing into that, sort of your ideas of mortality, and I was still in my 40s at that point, so there was a fair bit of, you know, career and life to live, and really no concept of what that actually would look like, and you have to go through a whole lot of different experiences perhaps to find that. I think it would have been always, it took me a long time, and I used this, I talked about this just before, the making piece, the idea of making, that I realized almost all my energy comes from making, and making can be in a creative sense, like even people who say, because I do the art and the writing and those things now, they go, how were you ever drawn to being a CEO, you know, in that way? But the aspects of CEOing that I loved most were the creative parts of it, you know, the team building, the strategy, the, you know, the idea sharing, that sort of aspect of it. The you know, when you talked about the ideas around branding, I loved how our football club could be a true expression of what it was. And being the CEO of three different clubs had very different expressions of themselves. Like Richmond and Melbourne, for instance, are 100 yards from each other or 200 yards from each other, but totally different energy and totally different stories. And Richmond's from struggle town, you know, Melbourne was traditionally more top end of town, you know, that type of thing. And allowing, you know, and giving both clubs the success without forgetting a successful sort of place in the competition without forgetting, you know, where they came from. So I think it would always come from a creative place, I would think. You know, it might have been design, or it might have been, you know, something which had a more pure artistic, you know, aspect to it. But it would have to have had, for me, some expression of creativity in something I cared deeply about. And I'm sure if I hadn't fallen in love with footy, I would have fallen in love with something else. And
it's I can see that. I was going to ask, attached to that, was there ever a sliding door moment?
Definitely along the way. Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, because it was even even as an 18-year-old, when you're doing your school stuff, what are you going to do when you leave school? Or a 17-year-old, I had no concept of that at all. I got into it was this new Fandang thing at the time, but it was marketing, you know, at Caulfield. You know, that was the course I would have done. But then there was a job halfway through year 12 for an assistant to the football manager of the Melbourne Football Club, and that was the job I applied for. But I also think about that because also it was at a time when my parents were separating, so it was actually a complex time in life, even because it was, you know, my father and my mum hadn't worked out, and, you know, so that was going on in the background of all of that. And I've often reflected, I wonder, you know, what role my father played in that without me ever knowing about it. I've actually thought about that lots of times since, you know, like even where things didn't work out for me and I did get the sack, and people say, well, why'd you get the sack? I go, well, I know the reasons I know, but there's probably 1,000 conversations which happen which I'll never know for them to come to that outcome or that decision. Yeah. And being okay with sort of not knowing is something which you have to, over time, obviously come to terms with. But I think it would have been a creative, and I really appreciate the question, because it's, there's no doubt there's times that I've identified too much of myself with the game. And like, for instance, in the time that I was in the sport, we never won a premiership. You know, we had some near misses and went close and were on track. And so, you know, and there was a beautiful comment by Nathan Buckley in regard to that. He said, I'm never going to define myself by that part of me. You know, you can only define yourself by the things that you did. And I don't have any regrets in regard to that, but I certainly have a lot of reflections and times where I go, yeah, okay, well, that might have handled that a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I often think about when you look at people and what they do, how they make that decision to do that, because somewhat that defines us. But I guess one of the things in connection with that, like, is absolutely see that creative bit in yourself, and it makes a lot of sense. To me, one of the other things I think about is, as a human being, are you happy? And that saying that happiness is the difference between your perception and the reality of existence. If you think that you're going to, it's like going to a party. If you think the party's going to be absolutely awesome and you get there and it's not, then you'd be disappointed. And the inverse is true. It's the same, I think, in careers. You often find yourself in a circumstance where you are doing something. The trick is to try and make yourself trick is to enjoy it. And be challenged by it, and therefore be happy as a result of doing what you're doing.
I like it even like when it comes to setting up design CEO in this business and took me a little while, but I end up sitting down and doing my own values. What are the values of this? You know, what are the principles of design CEO? And it was the G. I'll come back to the G, you know, because the MCG and the G was actually for us, yeah. So they're all G's, yeah. So the first one was, yeah, it's generous. It's going to come, we're going to be generous in what we bring, and not cheap, but generous is, as in we're going to come from a place of generosity in regard to this. You know, it's going to be, it's going to have that. Yeah, we're going to be grateful. Look, I'm grateful for this conversation. I'm grateful for the relationship we've formed. I'm grateful the people will invite me, as you did, into your boardroom and to talk to your team. I'm grateful for that opportunity, you know. And then it's this idea of just goodness. It's got to come from the better part of you. It's got to come from a deeper, thoughtful, almost loving part of where, you know, what you found to be important. And the last one, and growing up in St Kilda, you'd be familiar with the word, is it's got to be grouse. It's got to be grouse, you know. It's got to be really good quality. It's got to have, this podcast has got to be good. You know, it's got to be meaningful. It's got to, the quality of the work we produce. And so the grouse is as in, it's going to have a high standard, but it's not going to take itself too seriously as well. So
just
fun along the way.
A combination of being genuine and you can be proud of what you do. Absolutely. I can see that.
So they're the sort of the G's, the four G's.
Yeah.
This has been a wonderful conversation. We've had a really good long chat here, and mate, this is a ripper. This is a classic. I'm so pleased to have got to know you. The opportunities of having conversations, I'm sure we'll have many more in the future, but thanks very much for joining us.
No, we will, and I feel humbled by being asked and the experience, because I listened to a few of your old podcasts, and you've had some great people on board, and I enjoyed those conversations as well.
Oh, don't worry, mate, this one stacks up big time, so it's a river. So thanks very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this chat.